From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
We talk with some of the students who witnessed the deadly shooting yesterday at Florida State University.
It was just very scary, and I'm thankful for law enforcement acting as quick as they could.
Also this week, the battle ramps up between the leadership of the Florida House and Governor Ron DeSantis.
And we have some of these leaders in the Florida House who are stabbing their constituents in the back.
We'll also learn how the federal immigration crackdown is playing out in Florida, and we'll talk with an expert on artificial intelligence. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com.
Here's an update on the story that led off our Capitol Report, the podcast, online yesterday. All victims who suffered gunshot wounds in yesterday's deadly shooting at Florida State University are expected to make full recoveries. During an afternoon news conference today, Tallahassee Memorial Hospital physicians said two of the victims could be released as early as this evening. Doctors said injuries included gunshot wounds to extremities, chests, abdomens, as well as one facial injury. Dr. Shelby Blank said the number of casualties in the shooting could have been much worse.
We were very lucky. Obviously, this was catastrophic, but given the numbers of students in that compressed area, the recipe for disaster is very scary.
On campus, makeshift memorials were set up near where the shootings took place in the area around the Student Union building, and vigils were planned to take place throughout the weekend. FSU senior Angie Genham was on campus during the shooting.
Being in that situation yesterday and it being real, not just a drill, was just very scary, and I'm thankful for law enforcement acting as quick as they could and just trying to get everyone to safety. And I just felt I needed to pay my respects today.
One victim who died during yesterday's shooting has been identified as Robert Morales. He was the university's dining coordinator. So far, there's no information on the other person who died. Governor Ron DeSantis today ordered flags to be lowered to half staff across the state through Monday to honor those killed during the shooting. Reed Sebold is a senior at FSU, and he was in class in the Bellamy building, where he says fellow students came running in, saying there was a shooting. They turned off the lights and barricaded the doors.
And then about 5 minutes later, we get an alert from FSU about a dangerous activity, and then it comes over the intercom as well. And then pretty soon after, it's confirmed as an active shooter by the university.
WFSU spoke to Sebold on the phone as police were escorting students out of the building and into another part of campus, and even then, he says, things felt scary.
I'm honestly terrified.
Sebold said one of the hardest parts for him has been feeling like he's helpless.
We should be okay. I'm worried about any friends on campus that were in any other places, but unfortunately, we just won't know until we know.
Although he was thankful, the friends he has heard from are all okay. Classes at the university were canceled today, the school offering counseling services for students and faculty. Members of the Florida House have been working to get to the bottom of reports Governor Ron DeSantis' administration routed $10 million from a larger Medicaid settlement from the company Centene through the First Lady's charity, Hope Florida. That money was sent to several PACs that worked to fight last year's ballot initiative about recreational marijuana. Pensacola Republican Representative Alex Andrade has held hearings in his committee over the past few weeks to get more information about what happened. Tristan Wood spoke with Andrade about the Hope Florida debacle and how it signals a shifting relationship between the governor and the legislature.
After the revelations about the money trail, what you heard from Hope Florida leaders during your hearing, where do you stand on the implications of this whole situation?
At this point, I'm comfortable saying that I believe James Uthmeyer and Jeff Aaron committed money laundering and wire fraud with $10 million in Medicaid money.
What specific things have led you to reach that conclusion?
Well, James Uthmeyer was involved in the settlement negotiations with Centene, between ACA and Centene. So if you recall, 2 weeks ago, I was questioning the ACA secretary about why on earth they would direct $10 million in taxpayer funds to this one charity called the Hope Florida Foundation. I had no earthly idea at the time what the Hope Florida Foundation had done with the money. I just knew that that was probably irresponsible and bad policy. I think it was against Florida statute as well for a state agency to direct taxpayer funds outside of the normal course of business instead of simply returning them back to the state coffers. But I do know that James Uthmeyer was involved in that settlement discussion and the decision to send $10 million to the Hope Florida Foundation. What we discovered after that meeting was that immediately upon the transfer of those funds to the Hope Florida Foundation, James Uthmeyer reached out to two separate dark money 501c4 groups called Save Our Society from Drugs and Secure Florida's Future, and told them both they should ask for $5 million from the Hope Florida Foundation. Then I know that he connected them with Jeff Aaron, who is the governor's personal attorney and also happens to be the attorney for the Hope Florida Foundation, who helped these two dark money groups paper a letter request, essentially, and immediately got the money transferred to these two groups. I do know that in the instance of Save Our Society from Drugs, the wire transfer from the Hope Florida Foundation happened on October 22nd without a board vote, without board sign off. They received $5 million on October 22nd. And the very next day, Save Our Society from Drugs transferred this money to James Uthmeyer's PAC called Keep Florida Clean.
As you're working to get to the bottom of what happened, Governor DeSantis and at some of the people that work for him in communications have, you know, said you and other House Republicans are selling out to the left for looking into what's going on and that the accusations are politically motivated.
This is a manufactured hoax, and you have liberal media and liberal Democrats pushing this. And we have some of these leaders in the Florida House who are stabbing their constituents in the back and joining with liberal media and liberal Democrats. It is a farce. It is manufactured, and it's part of their political agenda.
What do you make of those comments?
Well, if you can't attack the argument, you attack the person, right? And in this circumstance, they can't defend the fact that $10 million in Medicaid money was improperly shaved out and taken from the state coffers and used by the chief of staff's PAC. They can't defend that, so they have to try and come up with other arguments to distract from the circumstance. It's somewhat mortifying, you know, as a state official to see that this occurred and to see kind of the shamelessness and hubris of those involved. But at this point, it's also not very surprising. Governor DeSantis and James Uthmeyer have acted like they're above the rules and the rules don't apply to them for a very long time.
Now, this Hope Florida situation is one of many issues that the governor has been butting heads with you and other members of the Florida House this session. That's very different than how the relationship has been in years past. Why do you think it's developed and is proceeding this way?
Well, I think that there has been a culture of permissiveness, but at the same time, I don't think the actions of the governor's office have ever reached this level before. I mean, there's no other circumstance I can identify where money left the state coffers not only taxpayer money, but Medicaid money, money that is subject to significant fines from the federal government if we misuse it. Medicaid money ended up in a PAC controlled by the governor's chief of staff. I haven't seen another circumstance like that in my time here. And so that I mean, while they might have gotten their way a lot more under speakers like Paul Renner, who did kind of just kowtow to the governor, this is a circumstance that is wholly unique from my perspective, just because I've never seen this type of wire fraud and money laundering coming out of the DeSantis administration.
Gotcha. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Republican House Member Alex Andrade of Pensacola speaking with Capitol reporter Tristan Wood. Coming up on Capitol Report, we'll hear the story of an immigrant from Honduras who suddenly found himself in custody and possibly facing deportation.
Our attorney came out and she told me that Josue was being detained by ICE.
What had been a legal deal meant to spare some South Florida jail inmates from federal custody seems to have fallen off the rails.
Haskell estimated between 9 to 12 people per month were spared from being handed to immigration officials.
The state of Florida moves to change all official references to a well-known body of water.
Without the United States of America, the Gulf would not be what it is today.
And we'll hear what an expert on the topic of artificial intelligence has to say about the possible future ramifications of this exploding technology.
I think we're on the precipice of creating a digital species.
WLRN's Tim Padgett has produced a story that asks the question, can the detention of an immigrant by federal authorities be legal and wrong at the same time?
For a fleeting moment last Tuesday, Jessica Rodriguez and Josue Aguilar thought their anxieties were over. At the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services facility in Kendall, they'd just been told that Josue's path to legal immigrant status had been approved. His marriage in 2022 to a U.S. citizen, Jessica, was deemed valid, and he had a good tax-paying job and no criminal history. For Jessica, it meant a brighter future for them and their two-year-old son, Joshua. But then,
the officer that was interviewing us told me that me and our two-year-old son had to be escorted out. And I'd say about 2 minutes later, our attorney came out and she told me that Josue was being detained by ICE.
ICE, meaning Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. They took Josue to the Chrome Detention Center in far west Miami-Dade County, leaving Jessica stunned.
I don't understand how they can give us such good news and then just rip it away, you know?
Josue is 26. He came to the U.S. 12 years ago as an unaccompanied minor fleeing gang violence in Honduras. In 2018, he graduated from Miami Beach Senior High School, where he played soccer. But his attorney, Valerie Crespo of Legal in USA in Coral Gables, points out there was one potential problem.
He had an order of deportation from 2018.
That was back when Josue had been a teenager seeking asylum. So technically, ICE could detain him. ICE says it does not comment on pending immigration cases. Still, in the past, migrants with Josue's sort of record were rarely targeted for arrest. What's changed, says Crespo, is the arrival of the Trump administration this year.
Right now, I believe they're only focused on getting the deportation numbers rather than evaluating who really deserves being deported and who doesn't.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem drove home that priority last week in a White House cabinet meeting. She suggested a greatly exaggerated number of deportations as President Trump's goal.
When you have 20, 21 million people that need to go home because they're here breaking our laws, then we need to facilitate that.
Immigration experts say Noem's claim of 21 million undocumented migrants in the U.S. is almost twice the actual 11 million. Either way, Josue Aguilar's attorney, Valerie Crespo, says the Trump administration's deportation obsession means people who thought their immigration cases were still open are at risk of being detained at status appointments like the one Josue went to last week.
When we moved to another room, there were the ICE officers, three of them, waiting for him. I advised him that this could happen because it already had happened with other clients this year.
Still, as Josue's U.S. citizen wife Jessica Rodriguez argues, the couple was doing things the right way, by the book. proving through the I-130 process that Josue was genuinely married to a U.S. citizen with a U.S. citizen child, and that he'd come to the U.S. as a refugee from Honduran gang violence that, a decade ago, was the worst in the world.
The only way that we can move forward with legalizing Josue's case was with our I-130 approval. We couldn't miss the interview.
But because of what happened to Josue and what's happened to so many like him since Trump took office in January, more and more migrants are now missing their interviews and court hearings and staying underground. Josue's attorney, Valerie Crespo, says immigration judges are getting exasperated.
Yesterday, I had a hearing and the client didn't appear. And the judge told me it is number 15 of the day that didn't appear. Now they're not showing up.
With so many migrants being detained or driven into the shadows, there's also a risk to Florida's economy. Undocumented migrants help sustain sectors like agriculture, construction, and hospitality. Franly Julien is an immigration attorney in North Miami.
I think this is a situation of limbo for everybody, and I mean also the private sector.
Josue Aguilar himself is a general manager at a Miami Beach restaurant. He has since been moved from the Chrome Detention Center to the Brower Transitional Center in Pompano Beach. Crespo has filed a stay of removal to prevent his deportation back to Honduras. Meanwhile, his wife Jessica Rodriguez waits for word of his fate in their North Miami home with their toddler son.
We don't know. They wouldn't tell him.
It's an uncertain situation many more families in immigrant communities like South Florida will likely have to get used to for at least the next 4 years. I'm Tim Padgett.
A federal judge recently said Miami-Dade County is in breach of a court settlement meant to shield some county jail inmates from being transferred to immigration custody. WLRN's Danny Rivero and Natalie LaRoche-Pietri report.
Florida law is supposed to protect undocumented immigrants in jail custody from being handed over to federal immigration if they were witnesses or victims of crime. That protection was emphasized in a 2021 court settlement with Miami-Dade County.
But for nearly 3 years, County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava's administration has been violating that court settlement, according to Federal District Judge Kathleen Williams. The judge said as much in a court hearing last week, and WLRN reviewed court records showing details of the noncompliance. The settlement is connected to a federal case originally filed by immigrant rights groups in 2018. Miriam Haskell is an attorney with the Community Justice Project, representing the plaintiffs in the case.
If we can't get their compliance after months or years of pushing for this, then what good is this? And we had an agreement that was signed off on and approved by the entire Board of County Commissioners.
The agreement was unanimously approved by the Miami-Dade County Commission in 2021. Dozens in county jails might have been transferred to immigration custody during the breach of the settlement, including being sent to Chrome Detention Center. That's the same facility the county mayor and other elected officials have recently requested to tour, following reports of inhumane conditions there.
The Miami-Dade County Jail, though, is absolutely a feeder to Chrome. And this settlement agreement provided an opportunity for those numbers to be reduced.
When the agreement was in effect between July of 2021 and September of 2022, Haskell estimated between 9 to 12 people per month were spared from being handed to immigration officials.
What we see is that our local government continues to try to do the work of federal immigration enforcement in a way that makes our communities less safe. And unfortunately, this is all happening in a county where the majority of our residents are immigrants.
That's Oscar Londoño. He's the co-executive director of the immigration group We Count, one of the nonprofits represented in the case. One person who benefited from the settlement was a victim of crime and was facing threats from the criminal gang MS-13, court records show. Other court records show applicants suffered severe beatings and said they could help prosecutors with their investigations.
Where Miami-Dade County has systematically violated a settlement agreement, and a lot of immigrant workers and families have been impacted as a result.
In a court hearing last week, Judge Williams alluded to the political climate, where first Governor DeSantis and more recently President Trump have threatened local governments if they don't assist with immigration enforcement. But she said that's not a valid reason to violate a court settlement.
The broader political environment is creating the conditions so that many more cities and counties are not doing what's right.
Being granted an exemption does not mean someone will escape pending criminal charges or will immediately be let out of jail. If an inmate is convicted of a crime, they can still face a prison sentence.
The protection simply prevents them from being transferred to federal custody since they have been witness to or victim of another crime.
The court also ordered Miami-Dade to pay over $350,000 in attorney fees to the plaintiffs, citing the long stretch of noncompliance. I'm Danny Rivero.
And I'm Natalie LaRoche-Pietri in Miami.
And as of this airing, county officials have not responded to multiple requests for comment. The water body formerly known as the Gulf of Mexico will officially change its name in Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation this week renaming it the Gulf of America. Adrian Andrews reports the change takes place this July.
The move comes after President Donald Trump in January issued an executive order declaring the name change. Now Florida is following suit in state law. Miami Republican Representative Juan Carlos Porres is behind a bill that requires state agencies to change all of their geographic materials. It also requires that school instructional materials be updated in K-12 classrooms. He calls it a step toward American exceptionalism.
Without the United States of America, the Gulf would not be what it is today. We enforce most and defend most of the Gulf. It is around more of the United States than of Mexico.
The House also passed a bill that update areas of Florida law that currently refer to the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf has made its name since the 16th century, but Republican Representative Wyman Duggan of Jacksonville says it's not out of the norm to change the name of geographic locations. During a debate on the legislation, he pointed to a few examples where names of countries have changed.
Ceylon became Sri Lanka. Rhodesia became Zimbabwe. This isn't out of the historical norm. It's consistent with federal law in the form of the executive order. If it changes in the future, it'll change again. I don't understand all the angst.
After Governor Ron DeSantis signed off on the measures, Senate President Ben Albritton took to X saying that Florida is proud to recognize the name change. He tagged President Trump in the post. Meanwhile, Democrats have been mostly against the move, calling it a waste of time and a slap in the face to the Gulf of Mexico name. Orlando's Democratic Representative Ana Escamani went as far as offering an amendment to rename the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of Endor, a name taken from a fictional place in the Star Wars movies.
I filed my Star Wars amendment really in jest, but it also speaks to how the arbitrarily renaming of bodies of water or historic landmarks is really a disregard to that legacy.
The Gulf will be officially renamed in state statutes and new classroom materials July 1st. I'm Adrian Andrews.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, amidst all the arguments and debates at the Florida Capitol, one topic that keeps coming up is artificial intelligence, or AI. How do you feel about artificial intelligence? Maybe you're excited or nervous about a near future that will surely include self-driving cars. On WGCU-TV's Southwest Florida In Focus, host Sandra Victorova spoke with an innovations expert about what the world can expect from his technology lab.
In the near future, could humans eliminate food waste or create fuel from seawater or bring fast and affordable connectivity to people everywhere using beams of light? Well, what was once considered science fiction is becoming reality thanks to brilliant scientists and techies at research hubs like the Moonshot Factory. That innovation lab is called X. It's formerly known as Google X. And that's where breakthrough technologies are being applied to some of the world's biggest issues. And to tell us about some of the inventions and solutions in the works is Clarence Wooten, an executive and entrepreneur in residence with X. Clarence, welcome.
Thank you for having me. And I'm glad you made the distinction, because since Twitter was renamed X, lots of people have, you know, a little confusion, but we were the original X. We were called Google X, so now we're X the Moonshot Factory.
Why that name? How does this work? It's certainly more than a think tank.
Well, when you think about we first put people on the moon, how difficult that was. And so when we talk about moonshots, we think about things that are incredibly hard to achieve. We don't just want to build companies that are 1X better. We want to build things that are 10X harder to do and 10X better. For example, X created a company called Waymo, which is a self-driving car company. And that's been probably 10 plus years in the making. And it's not the kind of project that any any entrepreneur could have taken on 10 years ago.
Right.
Right. It really required the resources of Google to be able to bring Waymo to market.
How do you decide what ideas you take on and what gets left behind?
It's an iterative process. It's one that no one individual controls. Oftentimes, we'll spend years working on something, and then once we realize that the technology hasn't gone in the direction that we think it will go, or it doesn't have the proper unit economics to make sense to turn it into a business, then we will cut it before we launch it into the world as an independent alphabet company.
So how large a role is artificial intelligence, AI, playing in the development of these technologies, these solutions?
Well, AI has been playing a tremendous role for inside of Google for a number of years. Google CEO Sundar Pichai recently stated on an earnings call, I believe, that AI is responsible for about 25% of the coding that's done all across Google.
Wow.
So not just at Google X, but across all of Alphabet, AI plays a big role, and I'm sure that will increase.
So help us to understand the big picture here. The development of artificial intelligence will literally change the future of people on this planet in ways that we just can't even imagine now, right? I mean, how big of an impact, a transformation will AI have on the world?
I think we're on the precipice of creating a digital species, right? So when you think about mankind and mankind's development, you know, it's all been measured in terms of productivity, right? So we're a lot more productive today than we were 100 years ago.
Right.
Now productivity will be taken over by AI because AI is actually smarter than us. And that will probably continue to be the case. However, that's going to sort of push the pace of innovation like never before in positive ways and in ways that we're not sure of. But it's certainly no putting the genie back in the bottle, right? So I think we need to leverage it and embrace it.
Folks have great, brilliant ideas, don't know how to get it off the ground, get it to market. What's your message for them?
When I came out of college, the world was a lot different than it is today. I know that there are a lot of students and young people who are a little bit worried about how AI is going to impact their ability to land jobs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. One of the great things about Florida Gulf Coast University that I'm finding about is its entrepreneurship school. If you're an entrepreneur, you really need to learn to leverage AI, even if you're not an entrepreneur, because if you don't leverage AI, you're going to lose out on job opportunities to individuals who do. And so that's what I'm here to talk about, how to leverage AI, because there's no putting the genie back in the bottle.
That's innovator Clarence Wooten with WGCU-TV's Sandra Victorova on Southwest Florida in Focus. Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Danny Rivero, Natalie LaRoche-Pietri, and Sandra Victorova. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.